Blog Talk Radio.
I'm sorry, Sister Sherry, your mic is open. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. I had just muted it.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you and welcome to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. And I'm going to go ahead and open up the mic of our other guest and bring this brother on. So next we have Brother Deshaun Muhammad, who is another attorney. He's actually been a practicing attorney since 2001. Over the years, Brother Deshaun has practiced law all over the state of Tennessee on a broad range of cases. He is a former Chancery Court Special Master for Shelby County, Tennessee. While he has tried many cases, both criminal and civil, he has found that his passion is in cases involving children and families. He has been an attorney for the Tennessee Department of Children's Services, and since that time, he has represented countless children and families in the court systems in cases involving delinquency, child abuse, custody, and all family law. He is a husband and a father of a toddler. So, Brother Deshaun, your mic is open. Brother Deshaun, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, sister. Good to hear from you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good to hear you, and thank you for joining this panel, where I know this is going to be an exciting panel because this issue is very important as we talk about, are we really watching our children? And what we really want to talk about is how black children must be the central focus. Now, I had from a panel that I was on, you know, black children must be the central focus of the system. But in actuality, black children must be the central focus of our system, of our community, because we have to get out of the mindset of asking others to take care of our children. Because as we'll talk about tonight, we'll talk about today, and we'll talk about yesterday. And what we're going to see is that things have not gotten better for black youth. This is, we know, genocide. And it is operated oftentimes beginning in these juvenile justice arenas. So let's just really jump into it. As your resume reads, Brother Deshaun, you talked about delinquency matters. You talk about delinquency as a term because we want to give legal perspectives and standards. So right off the bat, we've got terms such as delinquency. We've got terms such as rehabilitation. We've got terms such as best interests of children. And when it comes to juvenile courts, those are important terms. So you want to kind of give us a brief thought on what is delinquency and what have you been doing?
Yes, ma'am. when a juvenile commits an offense, it's called a delinquent offense as opposed to a crime, because the person who did it is not an adult and not capable of the same thought process that an adult would go through. And so it's called a delinquent offense because they're not being charged with a crime. It's to go through the juvenile system. And the point of the juvenile system, as you stated, it's supposed to be rehabilitation. It's not to punish. The goal of the system is to help children get to a point where, you know, they're no longer committing these acts, and to help them become productive citizens. Or at least that's what it's supposed to be. And everything that's done is supposed to be done in the best interest of the children. And so I treat my job as basically as being the person whose duty it is to see to it that they carry out theirs. I'm always seeking to rehabilitate my clients. I'm always seeking to try and find a way to put them on a better footing, because oftentimes what they're accused of is only a very small part of the picture. They're accused of A, but oftentimes I might have a client who's accused of an assault, but no one's talked about the fact that this child has been bullied and made the centerpiece of mistreatment for a prolonged period of time, and now he snaps. And when the child snaps, then he's going to juvenile court for an assault. And the teachers may have been aware that he was being bullied. The teachers may have been a party to it in mistreating the child, but it doesn't matter because he gets in front of the court and he's treated as, and so I always want to rehabilitate my client. I want to find out what caused all this. Was he in fact the person who started all this, or was he just brought into it?
Good point.
Those are some of the things that we deal with.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And Sister Sherry, I want to bring you in because you currently work for the Department of Juvenile Services in the state of Maryland. So could you talk about rehabilitation and what does that mean, and what's that supposed to look like in the juvenile system?
That's a good question. In fact, in Maryland, it used to be called the Department of Juvenile Justice, but for the exact reason that Brother Deshaun was talking about, in 2000, under the current secretary, they changed the name from the Department of Juvenile Justice to the Department of Juvenile Services, because as a part of rehabilitation, we are supposed to provide services to the juvenile, to the young people who come into the agency and who are detained in the facilities. The goal is to first and foremost try to provide services in the community. Detention or commitment of a youth is the last resort.
Mm.
And people will often complain or get upset. So in most, I don't know how it is where Brother Deshaun is. I know here in the state of Maryland, oftentimes there's conflict. Conflict because on the one hand, those of us who work within the agency, we understand I don't want to say mission is, but what it is that we are supposed to be doing. But to the larger society, you often have people screaming for quote-unquote blood because they feel like these youthful offenders are not being treated harshly enough? Why was he or she still at home? Why weren't they detained? Well, because detention is really the path or commitment is the path of last resort, because detention does not always equal rehabilitation. And unfortunately, yes, in some places, for instance, here in the state of Maryland, it's really kind of appalling that many of the long-term detention facilities for youth are right in the same area as prisons. So you may have, for instance, in Western Maryland, you may have an area, I'll use an example, there's a town called Hagerstown. They have, in Hagerstown, they have three prisons right on the same street, right on the same road, long stretch of road out in Western Maryland, nothing else around, farmland, whatever. But on that same stretch of road, matter of fact, before you get to the prison, you get to the youth detention center. It's almost like the message is, this is your first stop, but down the road is your next stop. So that can become disheartening. And it makes you wonder if we're just giving, if government is just giving, what's the word, just
lip
saying
service.
Things without the intention, just giving lip
right.
service.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
To
misleading.
Concepts without having the intention of actually putting those concepts into practice.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That's an excellent, excellent point. You know, I was actually pulling some information offline. So let's start with, this is from the Children's Defense Fund website. So 2020 is the year, according to their website, is the year that children of color became the majority of children in America. Isn't that interesting? So 2020 is now deemed the year that children of color became the majority of children in America. And we know that we've been taught that there's a scheme, you know, just as Pharaoh killed the boy babies, kill our children, kill black people. And there's always been, going back to the 90s, this issue about the browning of America, the birth rate of white Caucasians has not been pacing that of children of color or people of color. So now we see that, according to their stats, 2019, children of color made up 49.8% of all children. And so we're saying now that the majority of children under 18 are children in color of 14 in 14 states. States such as Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, children of color make up the majority. And so, you know, my point is, of course, is that now as we're seeing this increased onslaught and this negative media and these killings and all of this increase in detention and arrest, you know, we would have to look at, is the plot, you know, thickening. And so I wanted to talk about, as you all talked about, the arrest and the detention and the failure to rehabilitate, because those are very big issues. And what we're seeing is that when children are put into prison and when there's this failure to rehabilitate, then this is making up for some of this hard mindset that we see. So here in Texas today, there was a article issued regarding Governor Abbott, and that article says that he has ordered an investigation into juvenile prisons. And it appears that there's raping going on in the prisons and there's abuse going on in the prisons in terms of beating up and you know, excessive force complaints. And we all know that that's been the case. And I think it's very interesting because as it is today, so it was yesterday. Because in 2007, you know, there were articles about, I think the act is called the Prison Elimination, Rape Elimination Act, Prison Rape Elimination Act. And this was an act that was signed into law by Bush. And so when you talk about the 200,000 adults and children who are incarcerated in prisons, they talked about the high numbers of people who are raped. And I think it's 200,000 adults and children who are sexually abused in prisons. Please excuse me for that. And so we see that these things, we're talking about what was going on in 2007, and we're seeing that here we are in 2021, and these behaviors are still ongoing. You know, then we come to the issue of gun violence. Now, I think gun violence is very interesting, and we're going to really kind of look at this because, as we know, everybody knows in the 90s, this whole super predator mindset was being lied and pushed, and you had people like William Bennett and Hillary Clinton who were pushing a certain narrative, such as the neglect of children and the parents don't want them, and then these children are going to turn into these hardened criminals who are just rampantly running through and killing each other. Well, here we are today, and according to the Children's Defense website, you know, you've got more than four times the amount of, I believe it was, soldiers killed in the wars. They talk about the gun death rates in 2019. And let me look at this. Since 1963, nearly 193,000 children and teens have been killed with guns in America. And that's more than four times the number of U.S. soldiers killed in action in Vietnam, Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraqi wars combined. And so we kind of, my thing always is looking at this, when they make these predictions sometimes, do we then see these predictions finally over the years become true? Is this that whole social engineering process? Because when we look at it, although black children and teens only make up 14% of all children and teens, in 2019, according to Children's Defense Fund, they account for, and this is black children, they account for 43% of child and teen gun deaths. 86% of children and teens who died from gunfire in 2019 were boys. Boys were six times more likely than girls to die in gun homicides, and black boys were 18 times more likely to be killed in gun homicides. You know, 85% of child and teen gun deaths occurred among the 15 to 19-year-olds. And so, again, this is something that is this some kind of predictive social engineering actuality that is we're now seeing? You know, we could go on. We could go on to the child welfare. We could go on to children being arrested and placed in adult jails, which in 2007, you had 7,500 youth in adult jails. And it's interesting because now it has decreased substantially. In 2019, you only have 653, they say. But what about the damages? What about the – what did we see? Mm-hmm. What kind of trauma do you see when in 2009 you had 2,743 children in adult jails? And so when we do the math on that, some of these people are probably between the ages of 27, 28, 30 years old, and the trauma that they suffered. So, again, we want to talk about what are we seeing, and so we can stop this cycle. Because, again, I know Sister Sherry and I had a conversation, and she talked about – we talked about the video game and the violence that is actually seen on those games, and then are we seeing that perpetrated in some of these court systems. So I'm going to pass the mic, and I want to tell the audience, if anyone's listening, please, if you have a question or a comment, press 1 to get in the host queue. So what about it? Anything that I mentioned, yes, does that give us any food for thought? Yes, sir. Go ahead, brother. Deshaun.
You talked about social engineering, and I was just listening to Minister Farrakhan a minute ago, and he was talking about how we're being socially engineered into these circumstances, much like when you said that our children are being abused when they go into these facilities. Well, just as you finish stating, those same children come out, you know, they're like 30 or so years old. So they're in the midst of having children. So you have somebody who has been damaged going into the prison system, now having children. What are they going to impart on those children? We have to stop the cycle. We have to actually work with our children, and we have to learn to love our children as a community, not just the parents, the community. Sister Sherry, I believe it is, stated that there's usually an outcry, why aren't we going for blood when a child commits an offense? But there are children. There are a future, and if we don't turn them around and we just let them go, then who's benefiting other than the corporations that use prison labor? Because some of these children are geniuses. The reason some of them get in trouble is because they're not challenged in school. I mean, there's a large list of factors that cause these problems, and we really have to take them into account because we lose so many of our best resources to this system in this way. And we have to turn this around because those are the people who can do it. We have to give them an opportunity, but we also have to see our children differently. We can't be afraid of the children in our community and see them as monsters.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. And, Brother, it's interesting that you said, I can't think of the lecture that the minister did. It was in the 90s, and it probably was around the time when he was doing Respect for Life or Stop the Killing. But he referenced that book, Monster. I don't know if you recall that. That was about a young man charged with murder, a horrendous crime. Mm. The title of the book was called Monster.
Right.
But there are so many layers to what we are dealing with, so that when Sister Pamela mentioned social engineering, it's layer upon layer upon layer. One of the things that the minister talked about back in the 90s, I started trying to do some research in preparation for this blog talk, just to think about how often the minister put forth solutions. So in 1990, or around about that time, the minister was on a series of lectures, Respect for Life. And the minister talked about what it is that we expose our children to. Like you said, brother, these are our children. What we expose our children to that has desensitized them so that they don't have a respect for life. We desensitize them with the video games that do killing and murder. We desensitize them with movie and theater and television shows that highlight murder and killing people and make it seem like that's something to be looked up to. So we are constantly desensitizing our youth so that they don't have a respect for life. Then he did right before the Million Man March, he did a whole tour on Stop the Killing. And again, he talked about the types of things that we expose our children to. And we say, oh, it's harmless. I get people all the time that say, oh, man, you know, Muslims, they spooky about that stuff. But it's not.
Right.
It's real when you start talking about the deep-rooted effects that these things have in the psyche of our children as they are growing and maturing. So if they start off at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 thinking that violence is the norm, by the time they're 16 or 17, That's all they know. Violence gives you power. Whoever can be the most violent is the most powerful. They're the most feared. It's like the whole thing with the gun.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, but your point was so powerful, and it's something that I've really come to pay more and more attention to, is the fact that the depiction of us and what we're allowed to in our music and everything, you rarely hear a black song about a family, about, you know, husband, wife,
right.
normal interaction. I have almost never heard that in a recent song that you know, commercially produced that we have access to. But if
right,
you go around and listen to country
artists, the people that don't nobody wanna
yeah.
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
the person who nobody's really listening to. But when you listen to country music, a whole mountain of songs about just what people did as a family. When you look at us in movies and such, you see us in the worst light. I remember in 1995, the minister was talking about how the whole world sees us in this way because Hollywood's gone before us and presented us this way. But we don't have very much in the way of positive, positive, you know, visions and such. My wife and I saw a movie recently where Kevin Hart was a family man. And it was so amazing because you don't get to see that. It's so rare. And so our children, oftentimes their only depiction of what it really means to be black, they're getting from a screen or they're getting from music. And it's a caricature. I remember in my old neighborhood, we didn't have drive-bys until the movie Colors came out.
Mm-hmm.
My neighborhood was never, you know, it was always kind of rough. But things changed when those movies came out. People learned, oh, this is how you do this different. This is how you do this better. And it changed the whole environment. And that's often the case. The movies, you talked about, when we talked about social engineering, that's very real because you put the thought out there in a study and then you create the circumstances to bring it about.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what we're facing.
Absolutely. Yes, and people get very upset with me a lot of times because when just like you mentioned, the drive-bys in your neighborhood, Baltimore did not have the huge gang problem that it has until the movie The Wire came out. Now, I'm born and raised in Baltimore. I'm not saying we didn't have gangs. There were always neighborhood gangs. But this whole thing with the organized Bloods, Crips, BGF, that did not become big in Baltimore until after the movie The Wire came out. And
yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
It's sad because that's how it affected our young people, that they glorified that. They glorified that behavior. They glorified gang affiliation.
Yes, ma'am. And you know, the thing as well, as we talk about looking to the black community keeps looking to the same resources for help, unknowing that these systems that are supposed to be rehabilitating our children or these systems that are supposed to be helping our children are the main perpetrators of some of this. For example, I was reading an article from 2007, and it was an article about South Carolina combating gangs, right? And so they were talking about the laws that were being enforced at the university, and, you know, they're investigating and you know, changing laws and enacting gang databases. But here we are in 2021, and the problem is much larger. You know, so we got to really look at why is the rehabilitation system not rehabilitating, and that's why I wanted you all to really talk about that from the beginning. You did so beautifully, because when youth are brought into the system early, it's supposed to be a deterrent. It's supposed to send them back better. You know, it's like an outcry. So we know you may have poverty. We know you may be mischievous. But if we bring you into a system that the taxpayers' dollars are used to, you know, to rehabilitate, why is it that our children are being turned back into our communities hardened, more hardened, worse off? And we know the answer, because this is what we see in court so many times. We see I want to say real quick, I saw the other day a supposed therapist, because oftentimes we want the listeners to know these presenters, these experts that are telling us how to help our children, Cajun, they're old white men or old white women or just people totally out of touch with our community, right? So I'm seeing this old white man lecture on fetal alcohol syndrome, because that's the new catch-all phrase, right? Fetal alcohol syndrome is responsible for every problem that exists, from irritability to not knowing how to read, to any of the most violent, you know, the emojis that they're putting on top of the children's heads as they're lecturing us, or these really angry-looking little monster emojis. And what is my point? My point is that people drinking alcohol has gone on for eons of years, before the 70s, before the 60s. Some people say it was even legal. So now they're trying to lump all the wrongs under this guise, because you know a lot of people drink. And so what are they saying? They're saying children who can't read, see, it's not behavior. It's an impairment. See, they have mental problems. They have brain damage. And so since they have brain damage, what does that mean? Y'all are going to medicate them. You know, you're going to try to eliminate them as some kind of morons. And, you know, it's just a bunch of garbage a lot of times. So that's just my little two pieces. So I'm sorry, Brother Deshaun.
Oh, yes, no, sir. No problem, man.
Yes, sir.
The point I was going to make is, you were talking about how these systems that are supposed to rehabilitate don't do so. But in truth, it's because the system was not designed to help us. And the best example I've ever seen of that is the treatment during the 80s and 90s of crack in the court system, and the
right.
current treatment of meth. It's night and day. Meth is a problem. Meth is something that we've got to deal with. You know, everybody should carry this stuff to help people who have overdosed and such. And these people have a problem that we need to figure out a solution to, and we need to do something for them, as opposed to don't do drugs.
Yes,
and then you won't have a problem. You know, there's a system being built around resolving the core issues with one, and when it with us, the issue is, well, you shouldn't have done it in the first place. And that's the same way our children are treated in the court system. You know, that in one case there's so much more attention to the root cause. As you see in every mass shooting, a swarm of therapists come down and talk to the children who've been through something terrible, these mass shootings. But nobody talks to our children.
That's right.
No group of therapists has come into the neighborhood to deal with our children when we go through something crazy. And that same trauma is continuing to grow in the community. It's trauma upon trauma. And these are the things that we really have to, those of us who have some some skill to offer, you know, if we have the ability to, you know, if we're therapists or something, we have to devote some time. I understand that we have hectic practices, but we have to devote some time to using that same skill in our community to try and help our children, because nobody else will. And those of us who practice law, I feel like we all need to devote at least a portion of our time to some part of our community, because we need it all over, because nobody else is coming to help us.
That's right.
And I think that would be a part of the solution, is that those of us who are the professionals who supposedly have some skill that helps other people, we have to devote it to our own.
That's right. Yes, sir. Beautiful. Beautiful comments. I'm going to take this caller. We have a Sister Walita Muhammad. I'm sorry, Sister Waletta. Waletta, and she's calling. Sister, you have a comment. As-salamu alaykum,
yes,
Sister
ma'am.
Waletta.
As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum salam, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Sister. Thank you so much for this show, this wonderful discussion and solutions. I'm just calling from Memphis, Tennessee, Mach 55. Just to say thank you so much for having this show and sharing this information and putting this information on the airline so that we can have something to think about as we strive to make our communities a decent place to live. So I just want to say thank you so much for this show.
Well, all praises are due to Allah, and thank you, Sister Waletta, for listening. That really does make my day to hear you, your comments. So thank you, ma'am.
Yes,
ma'am. I'm sorry. I'm kind of my using the keyboards. But, you know, I wanted to say, and I do thank you so much, Sister Waletta, for that comment, because our purpose here tonight is we want to change the way we see youth. We want to change the way we see the cause of the problem. As the brother is saying, it really is cause and effect. And so oftentimes we are given this mystery, like not understanding that some of this is definitely, all of this is within our ability to help and change. And so changing the way we take responsibility for the problem, it just kind of irritates me, because when I saw the on incessant news media about the violence and the children, it's kind of like, well, what did we think was going to be the result of children who have been targeted since the 90s? Even before then, our black youth, our black males have been labeled super predators and have been, mistreated, going all the way back to slavery. So as Brother Deshaun was saying, the trauma, it does finally get to you. And so we want to stop being on the end of the effect. And we want to try to get some solutions and stop looking at white people as the saviors on this thing. This is a really important point we have to look at. You know, going back, I do want to bring up the point that I made about this fetal alcohol syndrome, and by no means am I not saying that some of these diagnoses don't have some basis in truth. What I'm trying to say is that to take away the responsibility of parents, community people, and teachers, and, you know, we in the faith tradition and neighbors, to actually sit out and try to train these children in terms of giving them discipline, giving them love, giving them food and nutrition, that could go a long way in solving these problems. So we can't let these people fool us into thinking that these are some mental health disorders that will only respond to medication, and then we see they're trying to vaccinate our children again. So I just wanted to bring up that point. Because I have a article that I've saved since 2024, I guess it was back in the 20s, and I'm trying to find it. But the point of that article was that in the Houston Chronicle, a psychologist predicted that the medications that we were giving our children was taking away their abilities to think, to love, you know, blunting their abilities to feel. And so this is going to cause and effect. When we see this is real, and so we have to stop and halt and not keep going down this cycle where failure to rehabilitate is what you'll get if we're just looking at these systems to help our children. So let's talk about the best interests of the child, because that's the standard for the audience that is given anytime the courts, you know, and we live in the South, so a lot of times it's white people, you know, this is their systems. They always talk about how they're doing things that are based on the best interests of the children. And oftentimes I find that to be very misleading. Is that something that anyone else has seen? It's used sometimes as rhetoric because it's really not looking at the best interests of black children because the system's biased. So anybody seen anything like that? Brother Deshaun?
I can say in terms of one incident that comes to mind for me that's a reminder for me, you talked about how these therapists are don't necessarily have our children's best interest at heart. And the most disturbing, because when children commit certain crimes, we have to have them evaluated and everything. And so, you know, the therapist says what's best for the child and, you know, whether or not they can determine right from wrong and all of those things. And the most disturbing report from a therapist I got was the most honest report from a therapist I got. He stated that this little girl that I had, who was about, I believe she was about 14, and her IQ was extremely low. He stated in his report that based on all of his cognitive measures and all of his tests and everything, she should not be capable of you know, assisting her attorney, and therefore it should not be possible to deal with her in the juvenile court setting. But, and it's the only time I've ever seen a but to that, but she is so street smart that she is in fact capable of understanding.
Mm.
That was something that was actually written into a report. And it really told me, you know, it was, even the judge had to concede, we can't give this guy any weight because this racist opinion was his. Because
right.
My client knows how to survive, she's intelligent enough to maneuver through the court system and had countless reports by this doctor on numerous children. But I've never seen wording like that until this little black girl who's able to just survive. She's the one who gets this treatment, and so we were able to fight that and get a new evaluation from a different therapist who said that, of course, this child is not capable of making these decisions. She was functioning on a very, very low level.
Mm.
But this therapist was so racist that just her continued survival was sufficient for him to determine that she was competent.
Yes, sir.
So that's
yes, sir.
We have to service our children. If no one else is going to do it.
Yes, sir. And you're so right, because, you know, a lot of this conversation, the negative, you know, scapegoating that the youth are somehow so criminal, they're so negative, they're just so unworthy, has permeated the news, as you all both were saying, painting them as these sinister, you know, just lying on them. So what one of the things that you all, we have a handout. That's something that we got in the courts. I got in the court, and I kind of wanted to use this as an exercise to give the audience a perception. Now, in this particular, and so this is a child who's brought into the system. He's kind of a typical child by the name of Christopher. He's fictitious. This isn't a real person. But this Christopher was 14 years old. Christopher's 16, and he's in the ninth grade. So that's going to give us a hint, a little bit of a hint right there. So Christopher, according to the allegations, they come upon Christopher fighting and stabbing another child. He's repeatedly stabbing this child with a knife, and this is at a high school football game. And the police come and they take Christopher into custody. And so oftentimes, we paint that picture, these two guys fighting, Christopher stabbing somebody with a knife. So he's just, the news would make us think, he's that monster for sure. So then when they talk about Christopher, they give Christopher a statement. And so Christopher's side of the story was that he was at the high school football game and this guy was talking. Okay, he's talking smack about our team, right? And so then it goes on to talk about he told the child, hey, you need to stop that. First of all, you're on the wrong side to be talking smack. But anyway, he told him that he should respect the home team. And so then the other child, who was the victim in this incident, he threatened to harm Christopher. He threatened to mess him up. And then, the Christopher, our client, he laughed and told him to try. And that's when the guy, the victim, he came at Christopher with a screwdriver that he had pulled from his pocket. And so then Christopher says that in self-defense, because this guy's lunging at him with the screwdriver, he pulls out a knife. And so there we have it. Now, we know one of the beautiful things we're taught in the nation is conflict resolution. So by no means are we saying that, proper handling of conflict, we get that. But again, we're looking at, was Christopher this major monster, that totally not in any kind of ability to rehabilitate. So as we go on in this pattern, we see that Christopher has prior court involvement because he smoked marijuana. So, okay, Christopher, then we talk about Christopher's family, and we talk about the fact that he lives with his mother and a sister in a two-bedroom apartment, and his mom, she works as a waitress. His father passed away 5 years ago, and his mother was unemployed the year before that. And then we go look at his development. Christopher's been in special education. Christopher's mom is saying that he's been hanging out all night lately. She's kind of concerned. Christopher's school history is that he's a special education student. He's got IEP since fifth grade. Again, Christopher's drug use is that he's used marijuana. So when they evaluate Christopher, they say he didn't seem remorseful and that he says he never meant to hurt the guy, but he said that the complaining witness was coming after him. So the report says that he has not learned how to manage his anger. And because his mom, she lets him go wherever he wants to go. And he's using drugs. Now, again, remember this, the marijuana we were talking about. So because of that, they recommend that he be transferred to adult criminal court. So now this is our hardened criminal, although it definitely was wrong to harm anyone. As you all remember, there was some allegation. Christopher said he pulled that in self-defense. But we're talking about, and I just kind of want to put it back on the panel. We're talking about now this 16-year-old who goes into America's juvenile system, adult system, and then how does Christopher come out? So, again, I'm using that to try to personalize some of these people that the news media is always pushing at us as being such hardened monsters. And so anybody have any thoughts on this type of, these are the type of scenarios that I'm sure you all see as well.
Well, it's interesting that we are talking about, some things even from Christopher's perspective as you give it in the scenario. But when we start talking about systems, okay, and how these things work out for our children, understand if Christopher had been a Caucasian child, the discussion would have what led him to it before they even talked about what he did.
Okay.
See, before they even talked about what he did, they would have already started the narrative about Christopher's life and the things that affected him. And we see that all the time when we see Caucasians accused of the same, of crimes even more heinous than what our people may be charged with. Look at Dylan Roof. They wanted to talk about poor Dylan, the stuff that happened to him that made him like this. And so our narratives have to come from, one, a level of compassion. But again, at some point, if we are going to effectively put things in place for our youthful offenders, we have to start trying to peel back some of the layers of the systemic things that are in place. Try to peel back those layers.
Yes, ma'am. You're right. Brother Deshaun, did you have anything you wanted to add on that?
Yeah, I agree with the sister wholeheartedly, because I think your narrative perfectly explains what we deal with every day, in that you have a child who someone's attacking with a screwdriver, and I have to go through this massive explanation of who he is to explain why he stabbed the person. Because I assure you, if I had a Caucasian child who someone lunged at with a screwdriver, we wouldn't have a court case. There's nothing to discuss. You have a right in America, if you are a citizen, to defend your life. A screwdriver is, in fact, a deadly weapon. I've had, cases where people die being stabbed with a screwdriver. It is, in fact, a deadly weapon. So to use a knife in defense of your life against someone with a screwdriver, there's no question. I mean, we have all these stand your grounds and laws and everything else, but the right to self-defense is primary. And the fact that we have to go through psychiatric examinations and explanations of how this child's family went, the fact that he used some marijuana at some point, and all these random issues is the best explanation of how racist this system is. Because I assure you, if I had a white child, I would not be going through any of those. I would simply have to show the other child had a screwdriver. He took it out in the midst of an argument. That's the end of the discussion.
Yes, sir. That's right. That's beautiful. Like you say, we've been at the table with people on these type of conversations, lawyers, and they give their opinion. And, well, the mama, she can't handle him. See, you're like, wait a minute, that don't happen. Just like you say, what is the issue? This brother's rights are the issues. His rights to actually have a lawyer that's going to defend him and make sure that he doesn't get enthralled in a system that will certainly put him on a cycle toward, risk of just having his life ruined. But I'm going to take a caller. I believe we have Sister Tiffany Muhammad. Let me open up her mic. Sister Tiffany?
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Attorney Pamela.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Tiffany.
Thank you so
ma'am.
Much for having me. I'm on the West Coast, so I definitely am still working. But I definitely wanted to weigh in or just greet your guests. And thank you all for being so you all are so valuable, your attorney post position, of course, but also being the believers, the advocates with love in our community. And so that puts us in a, in my opinion, that puts us in a position to really be effective and cause substantial change. So again, I do have to go. I'm still at work, but thank you so much, Attorney Pamela, and thank Dr. Ava Muhammad for all that she does in creating these platforms. They are so invaluable because in the end of the day, we can't rely on, you know, as an attorney myself, but we understand this system and, you know, we, be it the criminal, the juvenile, I do sports entertainment, I do immigration. We know at the end of the day, you know, who this is. And we know that the answer is separation. But at the same time, we know that it's information. Because I'm listening to the hypothetical with the young man at a high school game, and, you know, and Brother Deshaun, Attorney Deshaun broke it down. You know, that's his daily activity. He has to defend his job. He has to defend and create or present the narrative that this person is not a terrible, horrible person. It was circumstantial.
Right.
And what it did for me initially, I just remember myself when I was in high school, you know, and how blessed I am. I would say the message to the black man for me kept me away from my juvenile delinquency because let me tell you, it was, you know, it was during that era where people were making money on the streets, you know. So what I'm saying is it's for us to give that information to be those saviors in our communities, you know, professionally, but also advocates in our neighborhood. We have believers with nonprofits and all those different platforms to be able to go and be the light in the darkness in our community and shed and to give this information. Because literally, the message to the black man, the book, it changed me over at the age of 15. I didn't have to do what I used to do. So we need to make sure that we keep, you know, as attorneys, super busy running the, you know, just doing what we do daily, but make sure we always realize our value and how we can affect change if we go out and do what you all do. You all work in family courts dealing with our children, you know, after things have happened. Unfortunately, I didn't hear the beginning of the show, Attorney Pamela. I will go back and listen to it like I always do just to hear the comments from Sister Sherry, Attorney Sherry, and Brother Deshaun. So with that being said, thank you all so much. Please, please continue this platform, Attorney Pamela. I'm so grateful. And, again, thank you so much for taking my call.
Oh, well, thank you, Sister Tiffany. Thank you so much, beloved, and all praises are due to Allah. Yes, ma'am, we appreciate your call because as she was, you know, she was saying so many wonderful things, especially about the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and message to the black man and how we have to get out here and put this information in our children's hands. I think earlier when I was speaking with Sister Sherry about this issue, she was reminding me of how in the Baltimore region, they'd always been told Islam is the solution. You know, I think you mentioned, who did you mention, Sister Sherry, who likes to say that?
Sister Anita Islam.
Yes. Okay, yes,
Anita,
ma'am.
Islam from the Ramadan prayer line.
Ramadan. Yes, ma'am. And that is
right.
Such a great point. Yeah, that's an awesome point. So, you know, as I was looking, my question really is, are black parents, are we showing up at the right time? Or, you know, or is court too late? You know, are parents really taking responsibility in some of these school environments or some of these environments to prevent their children being caught up? And that's us as Muslim parents as well as our people, because I want to throw this out there. Sister Sherry, as you know, you shared a documentary that I think is excellent. Perhaps you'll tell us where we can find that documentary. But it was a documentary where a young family, their daughter was actually preoccupied on social media, and she got caught up in a very negative outcome as a result of someone preying on her in social media. And her parents, unfortunately, very good, awesome parents look like, but they didn't even know, you know, they didn't know what to look for. So I think a lot of times, even with the broader issue that we're speaking about, are we really watching our children? And I want to say to the callers, if anyone wants to make a comment or have a question, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. Yeah, are we really watching our children?
You know, that's interesting because when I was coming up, my mother told me I did not have a room, so to speak. I had a room in her house that she allowed me to occupy. That being the case, I didn't have any rights to privacy. Nowadays, we under the argument of, you can't violate their rights. You setting them up. You preparing them for the prison system. No, I'm trying to keep them out of the prison system or out of the prison system. So with my daughter, I did monitor her social media. My daughter's 32 now, so the first social media was, for her was, what was that? It wasn't even Facebook. What was before Facebook? MySpace. And so, yes, I monitored her MySpace. I checked. And even when Facebook first came out, and even as a Muslim, I went and deleted some grown Muslim men off of my teenage daughter's page. My brother, you ain't her friend. And it might have been harmless. Everybody might have been all into, but no. Every Muhammad, I went and grown and deleted when my daughter was a teenager. I went and unfriended a whole bunch of grown FOI. I sure did. And I sure did say to my brother Captain, y'all need to teach this in FOI class and tell them, these brothers, don't be friending these little girls. And if the little girls request them, refuse it. And there's a reason for that. Why do you think the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us don't even let our children, our girls get accustomed to sitting on the laps of uncles, cousins, and grandfathers? Because the prey, P-R-E-Y, the prey begins, it's not always something outside of your immediate atmosphere. The documentary that Sister Pamela is talking about, which is called Prey, it's on social media and it's on YouTube. The director is Laverne Witt. But it ends up, well, I'll let you all look at it because you'll be surprised to see who was preying on the young people. And it was somebody that young people trusted. So we have to always be cognizant. And so we have to, it's a fine line between, quote unquote, policing our children and guiding them. I'd rather err on the side of caution, though. I'd rather have my child feel, oh, my God, my mother do too much. I'd rather have my child feel that way than to have my child come up missing because I didn't do enough.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And we see that as a result of this system. And you know, this is at the root of why the child welfare system, and this is another quote from the Children's Defense Fund, a child is removed from their home and placed into foster care every 2 minutes. This is what they're saying. And we know that part of that is the separation between the child and their parents, because if they can separate the children from their parents, which I see a very concerted effort to do that, and not just physically removing children from parents, but actually mentally, there's a lot of media, a lot of movies, a lot of peer and celebrities that push this agenda that parents are not your child's primary go-to people, people that you can trust. And that is, as we know, so false. But again, this is the enemy's agenda as we look at 2020, the year that children of color have become the majority. So this enemy is pulling out all stops, children. And so I think what you say, Sid, Sister Sherry, is so important about teaching our children, keeping our children mentally and emotionally, you know, feeling comfortable with parents as the primary people that they talk to, that they deal with. And too often, unfortunately, with our brothers and sisters who don't have these teachings, you know, they're too trusting of these school systems, that, you know, special education, Ritalin, all of these IEPs, you know, the school system being the pipeline to the prison. So, you know, this trust factor. And so I just kind of wanted to throw that out there. This is one of the reasons why during this pandemic, where children had to stay at home more with parents and parents were forced to educate their own children, they got comfortable with their children, they had to develop routines, the system and the talking heads that represent our enemy really began to complain and fearmonger and talk about, oh my gosh, what are these children doing at these homes? These parents are not treating them right, and trying to really penalize parents and send, you know, did y'all see that among the child welfare system's rhetoric? Because pandemic did allow parents to bond and teach their own children. And we know in Islam and the nation, you know, we're taught that the first teacher is the mother. You know, and we have independent education, and I think that needs to be one of the solutions that we look at when we talk about, are we really watching our children? Because a lot of times these school systems are not able to protect our youth. So
what?
I know I said a mouthful on that. Go ahead, brother. Please, brother Deshaun.
One thing, you said that the mother is the first teacher, and that's 100% correct. But the family can't stop learning, can't stop studying at, you know, at the point where the child goes to school, because as either you or the sister were talking about, in terms of social media and what the children are exposed to, the parents have to continually educate themselves about what, you know, the different media that the children are interacting with and how that works and how, you know, how many different layers of social media there are. Because if you still functioning on the on what Facebook was when it first came out, and your child is somewhere on TikTok doing whatever, then you're missing a whole bunch of interaction. So the parents have to really pay attention to what the child is doing and learn about what the child is doing. If your child plays video games, you need to play video games. You need to know what's in what the child is doing. Oftentimes now, in terms of the video games, the game may be bad, but they're interactive. So the people that they're interacting with may very well be adults. May very well be adults who are communicating with them through the game, and the discussion may be whatever. So the parents have to be involved in whatever it is the child is involved in, or else you don't really know what your child is doing. So what I would say is education is the key, but not just sending your child to school in terms of education, because I think we've established if that's not always your friend. You have to educate yourself as a parent to understand what it is the child is dealing with and who they're interacting with. Because if you don't know the other parties that the child is playing this game with, then you don't know who your child is interacting with.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's just so important, because we have, you know, gotten to a point where for the last, like I say, 30 years, a lot of this same we best interest of the child, no child left behind, you know, all these different programs have been pushed out that are supposed to help black people and people of color and poor communities, and it's only resulted in our death and our demise. And so it, you know, it's very interesting. I'm looking at Sister Charlene's article, Will You Let Your Children Be Guinea Pigs? And that's on the issue of the COVID-19 and the vaccines. But, you know, it's just very interesting because the minister is talking about how when you look at documentaries about animal life and the beauty of every creature trying to protect its young, he said, and I look at every mammal, every mother protecting her offspring from the natural enemy that will take advantage of it in its growing up. He said, it's weakest. So Satan is like that too, he said. Minister Farrakhan, during the remarks concluding the COVID-19, the virus and vaccine plenary session held during our Savior's Day. So he said, you know, he wants to put needles in our babies. Tell him, not today, stated the minister. And I think that is very important in this time that we're living in as we see this being raised in the different public school environments. But it's also a good point to look at with these solutions that have been continuously pushed out at us as black people, and we have to say no. You know, we have to make our own communities decent and safe places to live, like that sister said, because the community, the supposed solutions that have been thrown at us, they're not changing anything. They're only making scenarios worse. And so even when our leaders, our politicians and lawmakers are, you know, advancing some of these issues that really aren't impacting the bottom line with our children dying in the street, you know, and then going into that, you know, punishment and scapegoating of the youth, you know, we, I think, as black communities, you know, it's just time that we join with those in the community who are progressive and want to change, make changes. If I can say this, I remember once I was at a conference and there were some Caucasians and everybody was trying to figure out how to stop what they call disproportionality, which is black people, we're represented in all of these bad systems, special education, prison, child welfare. We're represented in those systems higher than what our population even is. And so it's like, well, what is the solution? And at this particular panel, a white woman, you know, was trying to tell us what the solution was. She had such great ideas. And okay, but, you know, I raised my hand and said, well, what about this? Why don't we get the money? Now, this is before I came to the nation. I didn't know how the system worked. I wasn't as wise as I have now since I've been studying these teachings, you know, more and more. But I said, well, why don't you all just give us the budget and we can fix our own problems? And that woman, she stood up and like a primal scream almost and said, oh, no, no, no. That, no, we made the problem. We helped cause this problem. It would be wrong of us to force you all to fix it on your own. You know, we have to be at the table. And, you know, that was one of my first kind of wake-up calls. I had been coming to the mind, so, you know, I was kind of like, wait a minute. Why we can't do this on our own? You know, so this is a lesson I think we're trying to get across to the audience and panel tonight, or the listeners, work with your children a lot of times without the, you know, exercise your right to remain silent. Exercise your right to parent your child. You have a right to privacy. That's a constitutional right that you're given as a family. So you don't always need people that you're not really sure that you can trust to be in on your, you know, decision-making process when you're in trouble, when your children need services. And that's why Brother Deshaun and Sister Sherry, both wonderful attorneys, are here this afternoon, this evening, to talk about black service providers you know, look for black attorneys that you can trust. Look for black therapists that you can trust. Anybody have any, you know, any closing remarks they would like to say on those issues? Because we're down to right around 9 minutes. So I wanted to please invite you all to make any closing remarks regarding how do we really, really, really watch our children as they grow.
I wanted to just suggest, you know, we go back, a sister from the West Coast, one of the things that she brought up was the teaching. And when I was trying to look up some things that I said, I was looking up some of the minister's lectures. And I remember the minister did the justifiable homicide, and that's a series. But when I tell you that I Googled that, Amazon it's a transcript. When I looked at it, and they said, y'all not going to be ready for this here. See, they analyze. They talk about the minister, but they analyze him. They were selling that thing for $902. And the blurb that they had on it, let me look at it, because I sent it to our legal counsel. I sent it to Brother R. to say, hey, listen, if this book is out of print, we need to put it back in print so that they can't capitalize on it in the manner that they're capitalizing on it. It said,
teach.
Justifiable homicide, and they said, black youth in peril, youth, parents, educators, and leaders to use as an educational resource. Okay?
What? Yes,
and this
ma'am.
Was on Amazon, and like I said they only had one book left, but the price they had was $902. That's how valuable they see it.
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. Okay. Thank you for giving us that information. That's very, very important. Very important that we know this. You know, we got to use what we have. I think we were talking about that in study group the other night. You know, we have all of this valuable tools, that all of the work the minister has given us, all of the information, and do we operate on it? Do we utilize it? You know, do we walk away from it as if it has no value? And their sister Sherry is telling us that the world, they know, you know, many, many of them know. It's a beautiful, beautiful addition. And Brother Deshaun, did you want to make any closing remarks as well?
I can say I agree with Sister Sherry. See Elijah Muhammad.
Yes, sir.
You know, we have all this information. The minister put out a book. If we're talking about education, the minister put out a book, The Torchlight for America, where
he
talked about a lot of the issues that involve our children and involve the school system and all these things. And it was put out, I believe, in the 90s, but everything he's saying is just amplified today and even more visible today. We have to step up and we have to fix it. Just like you were saying, give us the money and we fix it ourselves. Well, we're going to have to take our own money and fix it ourselves, because nobody else is going to fix it.
And that's exactly right. You're so right. You know, because even with youth representing such a large population, they say the federal dollars, they don't go toward youth. Youth get a very small percentage, you know, of the money. And so we know even still anything that
will go
toward
youth gets a lot of money.
There you go. You're right. Thank you for that. And building prisons gets a lot of money, doesn't it? So I forgot about that. You're so right. And you know, and I was reading, I want to take this opportunity to tell our listeners about the child welfare system and how these things are operating underneath our noses, because there was an accident in Alabama. I think, where there were 10 people killed on a van. It was a heinous accident. They talk about how it was some foster children, but little did we know that these were black children. And so I want, you know, something that I've noticed. A lot of times when you see images and pictures which show, like, problems, they'll put a white child's face. Like, I saw a picture of a white child, a little infant, and the police had the baby holding it because they were talking about traumatizing that's going on when these police are coming into these homes. They had this little white child. Well, you better believe that those are really black people. We got to look past, you know, what this enemy is trying to mislead us on, and know that these are our people that are suffering. So we have to, we have Muhammad's economic blueprint. You know, we have what the Muslims believe and what we want. And then we have our, you know, our 10,000 fearless and justice, what is it, justice or else platforms. So we definitely have the teachings and the ability to build and to solve the problems that are facing our families and our youth with the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad through the Honorable Minister Farrakhan. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you all so very much for being guests on this show. And the title was, Are We Really Watching Our Children? And as we gave legal perspectives and standards and our own, you know, personal opinions and input, I pray that we said something that can be of some help to those who aren't in the actual belly of the beast courtrooms, seeing this processing going on, these slave, just like cycles. You know, the children are going, like Sister Sherry said, they're leaving with the little orange jumpsuits and the little juvenile courts all, and they're going straight to the incarceration of the adult prisons. And then many are coming back into the community, you know, hardened and angry and justifiably so. So I think there's a lot of work that we can do. And again, I wanted to thank you all for coming on, because this is a very important topic. So thank you to the listeners. I want to thank Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad and the Elevated Places Network. I would like to thank my executive producer, Sister Samaya Muhammad. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team. That's Sister Rona. That's Sister Donna Muhammad. That's Brother Terrence Muhammad. I would like to make sure and remind everybody to tune in on Thursday at 7 o'clock p.m. to the Ask Dr. Ava show. That's Dr. Ava Muhammad, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad's show on the Elevated Places Network. And as always, let us remember to attend our study groups, our Wednesday night meetings, we have Sunday meetings, and all of the wonderful information that's being given. I want to thank Brother Ishmael Muhammad for his lecture on Sunday, because I think he talked about, really, are we watching? Are we actually seeing? And so that was part of where I got the thought about, are we really seeing what's going on with our children? So thank you again for listening, and I would like to say assalamu alaikum and tune in next Tuesday for A Time for Justice at 7 o'clock p.m. Assalamu alaikum.